Translation: the primeval Lord then assumed the form of a tortoise incarnation in order to serve as a resting place, pivot for the Mandara Mountain, which was acting as a churning rod. The demigods and demons were churning the ocean of milk with the Mandara Mountain in order to extract nectar. The mountain moved back and forth, scratching the back of Lord Tortoise, who, while partially sleeping, was experiencing an itching sensation. Please repeat. The primeval Lord then assumed the tortoise incarnation in order to serve as a resting place, pivot for the Mandara Mountain, which was acting as a churning rod. The demigods and demons were churning the ocean of milk.
The demigods and demons were churning the ocean of milk.
With the Mandara Mountain in order to extract nectar.
With the Mandara Mountain in order to extract nectar.
The mountain moved back and forth.
Scratching the back of Lord Tortoise.
Who, while partially sleeping, was experiencing an itching sensation.
Okay, Maharaj, I'm going to need just a little extra time here. I got to move some things around the screen so I don't have to disturb the slideshow. Okay, now I'm going to mute everybody. Except for you. Now we're ready.
Okay. And if you can see the slideshow there, we got a little black and white drawing of Lord Tortoise. Looks like French, like Boise, Lord Tortois, Tortois. And many, I found many pictures on the internet of Lord Tortoise. Yeah. And let's go to the next slide, number 5. Another one. It's a nice, colorful, cartoon-like picture of Lord Tortoise. And just to review kind of quickly here, Lord Brahma is describing all the incarnations because Krishna is present in this world through his energies, Bhumir, Apalam, Nalo, Vayu, Kamano, Buddha, Evacha. And he's also present through his incarnations. Of course, so many incarnations, Lila avatars, Purusha avatars, Manvantars. Now he's describing, I think, what is it, specific incarnations with specific purposes or something. And some are Shakti Vesh, some are Lila. And the very beginning, he actually described Purusha avatar, like that, and Mahavishnu. Yeah. But so far, we've heard about the boar incarnation, Suyajna, who's a grandson of Swayambhu Manu, who became the Indra, and actually an incarnation of Vishnu. Lord Kapila, Dattatreya, the four Kumaras, Chatursan, Naranarayan, and then Prishnigarbha, who appeared to satisfy Dhruva's desires. And then Prithu Maharaj, who's Shakti Vesh avatar for maintaining the people. Then Rishabhdev, who comes to teach the path of Paramahamsa Yoga. Hayagriva, a horse incarnation. And then the fish incarnation, and today, the tortoise, like that. And of course, the idea is that by actually contemplating these, appreciating them, then we can approach Krishna and understand Krishna really, his full personality like that. And right now we have Harry Potter and Spider-Man, other supernatural people. But we accept them kind of like in some way as existing as kind of like, you know, imaginatory entities or something like that. You know, we're not uncomfortable thinking about Spider-Man or something, you know. But we don't really connect them up a whole lot with our life and maybe with our real motivations in many ways. You know, maybe. Yeah. And so maybe we have the same idea about God. Oh, yes, there's Krishna. Krishna does this. Krishna does that. And we have so much philosophy, lila stories. But to go and penetrate, understand deeply, then we have to go through the different incarnations in a more considered fashion, it seems. Okay, next slide, number 6. Okay. And here's another picture of Lord Tortoise. And you see people are trying to deal with this. You know, with devotee down below chanting his beads, worshiping Lord Tortoise. How do you deal with this, you know? Maybe we can discuss that a little bit. How can the, because in the picture, what do you draw? Do you draw a tortoise with, you know, just a human face, or do you draw, here they have a tortoise body, very beautiful, with a Lord Vishnu resting on it with a full Vishnu form, which is still unusual because he has four arms like that. And he has a chakra floating around his finger and lotus like that, floating around like that. Yeah. Next picture, number 7. And here's one more picture. And here it shows the demigods and the demons churning the ocean of milk. Of course, this will occur in the 8th canto because first canto is a preface, second canto is Srimad Bhagavatam begins with Sukadeva Goswami, Krishna Maharaj Pariksit. In the 3rd canto, Swayambhuva Manu occurs. Then Maharaj Pariksit says, please tell me all about the different descendants of Swayambhuva Manu and all the incarnations of the Lord that appeared during those different Manus. So then canto 3 through 7 is all about Swayambhuva Manu and his descendants. For that we have an acronym, DAP UP, Devahuti Akuti Prasuti Uttanapada Priyavrata. First are the Uti sisters. These are all the children of Manu. DAP UP, Devahuti Akuti Prasuti. And this is in the order in which they occur in the Bhagavatam, and the whole of Bhagavatam is pretty much strictly organized from the 3rd to the 7th canto on their incarnations, their children, like that. Devahuti, of course, occurs in the 3rd canto, her son Kapila. Akuti married Ruchi and had Suyagna, who we discussed before, and his wife as his twin children. Then Prasuti married Daksha, the whole story of the Daksha Yagna. In the 4th canto, we go to Uttanapada, who had Dhruva for a son. That takes us on down through Maharaj Vena and Prithu Maharaj. And that canto characterized as DDPP. Canto 4 is DDPP. Daksha Dhruva Prithu Pracheta. Or also it can also be Prachindi Barihi, the last P like that. Yeah. Daksha Dhruva Prithu Pracheta. And that's all the children of Uttanapada. And the 5th canto goes to Priyavrata, the last son, and his son, I think Agnidra was first, then Nabi. And Nabi was the father of Rishabhdev. Rishabhdev was then the father of Bharata. And that pretty much finishes the whole canto off. You know, like that. So then after that, we go to the 6th canto. And because hell was described at the end of the 5th canto, in the 6th canto, it talks about how you can get people out of hell. And that's the whole story of Ajamil. Ajamil was saved from hell. Then it goes back to the Prachetas, who we left underwater, holding their breath, chanting their mantra in the 5th canto. And they had Twashta and other people for children, like that, produced all this progeny. And then Vitasura was born because it was killing Twashta's children, you know, left and right, kind of like that, you know. And so then Krishna took the side of Vitasura. And a question arises in the 7th canto, Maharaj Pariksit says, well, if Krishna is equal to everybody, why do you take the side of the demigods against Vitasura? And then Krishna explains that in terms of the story of Hiranyakasipu, and how Hiranyakasipu would only approach the Lord from a angry point of view as an enemy. So Krishna said, okay, if that's all you'll do, then I'll reciprocate in that way. And he purified him. So Krishna is equal to everybody, but different people are approaching him in different ways. Then that's the 7th canto. Then there's a little bit of a discussion of Varna Ashram, And finally, that finishes off all the descendants of Swayambhu Manu. Then Maharaj Parikha says in the eighth canto, what about the other Manus? So then the eighth canto talks about the other, all the other Manus up to our Manu, Vaibhasvata Manu. And of course, he then is the basis of the ninth canto. In his line appeared Krishna and Balaram, as expanded out in the tenth canto. 11th canto goes back to Vaibhasvata Manu, and the little kings and so on after Krishna and Balaram. And 12th canto is the glories of Srimad Bhagavatam, Sahari of Srimad Bhagavatam. So we had the whole Srimad Bhagavatam in 8 minutes. Okay. So right here and now, we got this whole story of the death gods and the demons, you know, spinning Mandara Mountain, and Vasuki becoming the churning rope. And of course, in the eighth canto, because this occurs during one of the other Manus, doesn't occur during Swayambhu Manu, this story will be told there. Okay, Lakshmi's on top. Nice picture. Number eight, slide number eight. Okay. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. And what does Prabhupada focus on? There's so many things. But it's kind of just mentioned they were churning the ocean of milk, you know? And so Prabhupada just picks out this one thing about the ocean of milk. He's a little worried here that his readers might think, oh, this is this mythology, this is unintelligent people imagining things and worshiping them. So then we have, go ahead here, 1 second. Hare Krishna. Okay. Yeah. Can you still hear me, Ramananda, everybody?
Yes, Maharaj, we can hear you loud and clear.
Because as you know, we've had given entire classes disconnected before. It's a thrilling experience to find your whole class was disconnected. Okay, purport. Although it is not in our experience, there is a milk ocean within this universe. Even the modern scientist accepts that there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of planets hovering over our heads, and each of them has different climatic conditions. Okay, slide number nine. Srimad Bhagavatam gives much information which may not tally with our present experience. But as far as Indian sages are concerned, knowledge is received from the Vedic literatures, and the authorities accept without any hesitation that we should look through the pages of authentic books of knowledge, Shastra Chakshurvat. So we cannot deny the existence of the ocean of milk as stated in Srimad Bhagavatam, unless and until we have experimentally seen all the planets hovering in space. Since such an experiment is not possible, naturally we have to accept the statement of Srimad Bhagavatam as it is, because it is so accepted by spiritual leaders like Sridhar Swami, Jiva Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti, and others. The Vedic process is to follow in the footsteps of great authorities, and that is the only process for knowing that which is beyond our imagination. Slide number 10. The primeval Lord, being all-powerful, can do whatever he likes, and therefore his assuming the incarnation of a tortoise or a fish for serving a particular purpose is not at all astonishing. Therefore, we should not have any hesitation whatsoever in accepting the statements of the authentic scriptures like Srimad Bhagavatam. So here's the second point. The first point is that there is an ocean of milk. The second point is that there is an incarnation of God as a giant boar, like that. Prabhupada said one time there's a world of difference between Lord Boar and the ordinary village hog. That, no. So both these things are beyond our imagination, and Prabhupada's pointing out that God can do anything, which he can do in a Christian country, kind of like that, you know? Slide number 11. Okay. the gigantic work of churning the milk ocean by the combined effort of the demigods and the demons required a gigantic resting ground or pivot for the gigantic Mandara Hill. Thus, to help the attempt of the demigods and the primeval lord, the primeval lord assumed the incarnation of a gigantic tortoise swimming in the ocean of milk. Can you imagine that for a second? Just kind of walk to the edge of the ocean of milk there, pick up a couple, you know, pieces of sandesh before you go swimming, and walk into the ocean of milk like that, and then swim around for a while. My goodness. Yeah. Actually, you would probably have a lot more density than water. Maybe some more density, so you probably could float even better. Yeah. One devotee one time, Bhadravardhan Das, he was a 10,000-year-old Tibetan monk in his previous lifetime or something. Maybe you know him. Very nice devotee. Anyway, we got this milk in Berkeley Temple, San Francisco Temple. We were getting this milk that was like too old to sell. You know, we would make it into paneer and stuff like that. But one time it was too old even for that. So we had something like about, you know, 15 gallons of milk, old milk. So he went into the Brahmacharya Ashram, the shower room there, and just took it and bathed himself in milk, gave himself an abhishek, bath, and 8 gallons of almost, you know, kind of a little bit thicker type milk. And he said it was such an incredible experience because your body is actually a permeable membrane. Stuff going in, stuff going out. So he said actually he felt like his whole body felt like creamy afterwards, you know, just enlivened by it. You know, so Lord Tortoise is swimming around there in the ocean of milk. At the same time, the mountain scratched his backbone as he was partially sleeping and thus relieved his itching sensation. Next slide. Okay. Okay, I guess that's the end of the purport, right? Yeah, okay. So then I was going ahead here and looking at this actual little scientific view of this, because Prabhupada said the Bhaktivedanta Institute, I used to work with the Bhaktivedanta Institute. I'm not exactly a scientist. Actually, I started in electrical engineering. I was building what do you call these things? Superheterodyne five-stage AM radios. Actually, I was at before I even left, ever got out of high school doing that. We'd be using vacuum tubes, you know. Then transistors came in. And then, okay, so a little electrical engineering, but it was pretty boring, actually. I could see where it was going, and it was nothing really that interesting. So I changed to biological engineering. And then we were doing surgery on animals and that kind of stuff, you know. And that was also a mechanical paradigm, so it changed. And I graduated in psychology, you know. So somehow or other, I got involved with Srupa Damodar Maharaj, and I was thinking, my goodness, should I get involved with the Bhaktivedanta Institute or not? I already went through science. You know, it's boring. So I asked Tamal Krishna Maharaj, I asked Rabindra, and I got a lot of input. And the final conclusion was that, yeah, Prabhupada wanted the science preaching. Tamal Krishna Maharaj told me, you know, very intensely, that Prabhupada said over and over again for his entire last year that scientific preaching is my number one preaching program. But he also said on one morning walk in the Cheviot Hills that, you know, science's prestige and fame and everything would drop down because they wouldn't be able to fulfill all the promises they were making, which we see, you know, coming down now in terms of being the solution to everything in life. So anyway, we were working with the Institute for some time. But the other guys were more hard scientists than I was, you know. I'm more like a cultural anthropologist in terms of like what it comes down to really, you know. So trying to put it all together, in some ways, everybody builds their philosophy of nature. Everybody answers these questions. The Bhaktivedanta Institute, Prabhupada said, was designed to preach to the scientists, but also to satisfy the devotees about these scientific challenges. The scientific challenge would be that there is no ocean of milk or these kind of things like that, or why do you say that? And of course, Sariputta, in his sacred geometry, and I think another one, Vedic Universe, he published a lot of information about the orbits of the planets and those kind of things, which makes it very intelligible, and it shows it, and it really shows the how provincial we are in our particular view of reality. We think that our mathematics and our use of certain kinds of energies, you know, to produce very subtle effects and examine the universe is the only one that exists. But now there's so much archaeological evidence, more and more showing up, that the previous cultures before us had many kinds of technology that it really seems we just can't even figure out what they were. We're able to accomplish things that we cannot accomplish now, like that, you know? Efficiently. And so it really seems that there are many other ways to manipulate very subtle, powerful energies and try to understand what is the whole thing like that. So looking at this, with some of our little views here, if you look at Srimad Bhagavatam 5.16.7, it says, amidst these divisions, or varshas, is the varsha named Ilavrita, which is situated in the middle of the whirl of the lotus. Within Ilavrita Varsha is Sumeru Mountain, which is made of gold. Sumeru Mountain is like the pericarp of the lotus, like Bhumandala planetary system. So we're on the Bhumandala planetary system. And, of course, they look at everything visually, and more subtle is tactile and more subtle is acoustical. The science is highly biased to try and understand everything from a visual perspective. So the planetary system is envisioned like this and that, try and understand it like that. But Bhumandala, mandala, the circle, mandala pati, kirtan mandal, what it's more like is a level of consciousness, a consciousness of beings who have to walk on the earth. Bhuvar is sometimes translated as the sky. And this is where you have floating planets like Avalon in the story of King Arthur, or floating planets like the Gandharvas, who Prabhupada says are fairies, and the fairies live on Avalon. So different you know, sources say the same thing. But their planets float in the sky. And the word planet, of course, is probably not a good translation. Loka means locus. It means that region, you know, the fairy region, you know. And then finally above that is Swarga, which is where the demigods live, in heaven, you know. Yeah. So starting to look at it like this and take a broader perspective, and it's not so crazy. Okay. Also, too, that Sumeru and Meru are the same mountain. Meru is sometimes called Sumeru, meaning very, very nice Meru. And it's interesting here, it's described as being made of gold. So Lord Kachup, he was swimming in an ocean of milk and having his back scratched with a golden back scratcher, like that, yeah. And this is all occurring in the ocean of milk, which is what? That's Sweta Dweep, you know, so very high level, even for the Devatas and the Dhanavas. Okay, let's go ahead here to slide number 13. The mountain's height is described is the same as the width of Jambudweep. Okay, getting Jambudweep is one of the islands on Bhumandala, our earthly planetary system. Okay, the Buddha is the same as the width of Jambudweep, or in other words, 100,000 yojanas, or 800,000 miles. Now, right away, you look at the authorities, they'll say, well, some people say a yojana is this much, some people say it's that much. Some people say it's the distance covered by an ox cart in one day or something like that, you know. But if you look on the invaluable Wikipedia, somebody posted there from some source that a yojana is, you know, a combination of another element, which is a combination of another element. Like, you know, 1 mile is 5,280 feet, you know, 1 foot is 12 inches, like that. So it goes back down to the basis of a yojana is the width of one finger, one anguli or whatever it is. And, you know, then 10 angulis equal this, 10 this, 10 these equal that. So then the question is right away is whose finger, you know, Indra's finger. This was spoken during at the end of the Dwapara Yuga. And so a yojana at that time may have been quite different than a yojana in the Satya Yuga. You know? And that's okay, because we're talking about a functional measurement, probably more than something which is, you know, constant like that. A yojana is width of somebody's finger. Okay, so, you know, for example, the Lord in the heart. He's the distance from your thumb to the end of your ring finger. Prabhupada says, yes, but this means that for the small animal like a rat, that's a smaller distance than it is for a human being or for an elephant. So the Lord in the heart is different like that, in that distance. So this is one thing right away we're talking about this. What is a yojana? Okay, that means that 16 yojanas are of Mount Sumeru are within the earth, and therefore the mountain's height above the earth is 84,000 yojanas. The mountain's width is 32,000 yojanas at its summit and 16,000 at its base. So on the right-hand side, you see here a picture of Mount Sumeru. Let's go down to slide number 14. And we blew up this picture. And this is common to the Buddhist description of reality. And, of course, all the Vedic descriptions like that. You know, the Buddhists have the same, pretty much same cosmology as we do. You know, Buddha didn't challenge that, how the universe was structured and all these things. Buddha accepted that, you know. So we see here then, I guess it's Bhumandal, maybe different kinds of circular rings or islands. And then right in the middle is Mount Sumeru. And it's more narrow at its bottom and bigger at its top. Slide number 15. Okay. He blew it up again. And I think this is a Buddhist one because you're going to see all the Buddhas and all the Arhats and all these people here. But right in the very top, I think, is Lord Brahma. And so let's go ahead here then, the slide number 16. Yeah, it's really blown up there. Kind of lose the details. And slide number 17, okay. So now here is our wild speculation. But that's the whole thing. You know, if there's nothing given exactly, you know, then you can use your mental speculation and try to arrive at different kinds of hypothesis. And then check those with whatever information is given, and you can start to confirm things like that. Anuttamadhikari is somebody who knows the scripture and has a developed logic. You know, logic means how you connect it all together like that. Yeah? Okay. So we all know about tops. Here's a picture. It was a little boy with a top on his table spinning it. Arrow there. Now, of course, the top spins around its axis. But text slide number 18. But also we know when it's spinning around its axis very quickly, it also has this kind of slow motion where it also spins around off-center like that. And the picture here shows it like that. It actually is called the precession, P-R-E-C-E-S-S-I-O-N. Okay. And there's even like a certain direction for it. And it goes at a certain speed, you know. The top may be spinning at maybe, I don't know, let's see, 60 cycles per second. Yeah, that fast, maybe 25 or something. And the general big motion, you know, conic motion is going maybe like, well, thinking maybe like 2 seconds, 1,001, 1,002, like that, to go like that. So this is what happens with spinning bodies. Slide number 19. Okay. Now here what we have is a picture of the Earth. Yes. Because the Earth is spinning on its axis, okay? But it also has the same top-like precessional motion. But you know, our other top on the table was taking 2 seconds to go through its precessional rotation. But how long does the Earth take to go through it? Well, if you can see the picture, it says right there, 26,000 years. So in terms of the stars, that means that the Earth, the North Pole, is actually rotating. It's interesting because Dhruva won't be the pole star, they're saying, after a certain amount of time. You know, 13,000 years will be pointed someplace else, and it will come back. So somehow or other, they're noticing, I guess, very small, you know, small motions. And then they speculate then, okay, this is what happens to these spinning bodies, and the Earth is going through the same thing like that, you know. What's our next slide? So this is our speculation because it's describing that Mount Meru is a conically shaped mountain, you know, with its bigger part down, smaller part down, and its bigger part up. Now, of course, that's totally contrary to anything we experience. We all experience that mountains usually have their big part down, and they get smaller as they go up. And I hear Hawaii is a little different than that, actually. Okay. Then this conical-shaped mountain, you know, as you go up higher, different devatas reside at different levels on it, you know. So our speculation, which matches up already, you can see some of the information, is that this is not a gross thing that you can has earth, water, fire, air, ether. It doesn't have any earth, doesn't have any water, maybe no, at least higher up. In the beginning it does. You know, in the beginning it says earth, and as you go higher, the water disappears, vapor. And then finally, tactile energy, color, fire. And then finally, tactile energy, you know, texture, like that. So as the earth spins around in this processional motion, from our point of view, it seems very slow. But from the point of view of higher beings, it's very fast. And so the same way, if you get a magnet in a motor spinning around, it produces this whole solid, you know, magnetic field, like that. You know, so on. So the same way, the earth spinning around in this processional motion, from the point of view of the demigods who live thousands and thousands and thousands of years, it's actually, the earth is actually spinning quite fast in this motion. And carving out a geomagnetic mountain, a geomagnetic cone, with a small part down, a big part up. And as we go higher, of course, the influence of the geomagnetic field is subtler, and of course that means you can do subtler things until finally Brahma's level, where he manipulates the whole universe on such a subtle and all-pervasive level that he's about three-quarters as all-pervasive as the super soul in his knowledge and his power like that. Of course, he can come down and put on grosser bodies like that, so on. So this is just one little like effort. And Sariputta, of course, you know, did that with the geometry, and to try to explain, you know, these apparent discrepancies between modern philosophy of nature and the Vedic philosophy of nature. You know, of course, the whole point is to try and, okay, this is reasonable, yeah, okay, and then I'll put some faith in chanting Hare Krishna, and then by the direct experience of the Maha Mantra, from the purified soul by following the four principles, we can directly experience, you know, in the most intimate fashion, more intimate than our mind, more intimate than all these logical systems, the reality of Krishna and what he's like, what the gopis are like, what Radharani is like, what Balaram is like. You know? And then from that perspective, we can, you know, adjust our relationship with the material world as much as possible, as much as we need to. If we need to understand about, you know, all these things in detail in our ordinary life, okay, you know, then we can understand that from a high perspective like that. One time, supposedly, Hansaduda told us that one time he was in Germany when Prabhupada was visiting there, and he came into Prabhupada's room. I guess they were, I don't know, somewhere in Berlin or Frankfurt or something, you know, and Prabhupada was sitting in his chair in the sunlight, you know, kind of meditating. And Hansaduda said, "Prabhupada, it says in your books that yogis travel on the sunbeams." And he said that Prabhupada responded and said, "Yes, I was experimenting with that in Munich," like that. So someone like Prabhupada, you know, traveling on the sunbeams, traveling on the airways, on the gravity ropes. Okay, as necessary, we can understand these things in different ways like that. If we have to become engineers, understanding Vastu, we have to understand astrology, or understand different things, like what's happening in terms of karma, mentalities. Okay, then we acquire as much knowledge of the material nature as is appropriate at that moment in our lives. You know? Other than that, we go up, and we get the connection with Krishna, and then try and purify our Tadgata Mulahantri, try and eliminate the contamination at the heart. So finally here, slide number 20, Prabhupada liked for us to know this Das Avatar Stotra. So actually, devotees can memorize one verse on each day for each incarnation. And today, of course, is Lord Korma. So here we have Kshitiri Havu Palu Tari Tishtati Tava Preste Dharani Dharana Kina Chakra Gariste Keshava Dritta Korma Sharira Jai Jagadisha Hare Dar. Shri Korma Avatar Ki Jai. Okay, last slide, 21. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Agatspa. You can see more of our vast speculations at www.jayaram.us. So any comments? What's one? Comments, questions?
Yes.
Criticism.
Atudananda here. I want to get this in. First of all, I want you to print about 20,000 copies of that outline of the Bhagavatam in 8 minutes.
Oh,
yeah.
It's available on our webpage. You go to our archive.
Now, announcement. Prishni Garba, we had a discussion. That's described in 10th canto and Krishna book, 3rd chapter, 32 verse to 42. And another comment. I like you mentioned the Spider-Man or something, because it just came to me. The original the Swayam superhero is Superman. What's his title for Kali Yuga? What's his Kali Yuga title? Man of Steel. Not Man of Wisdom. Not man. You know. Now my question though. Sadaputta taught me, and I forgot. Lost my notes. There is a number of elements in the most complex, non-living, I think, liquid crystals compared to the number of elements and protons in the simplest living thing. Something like, I remember one of them was something like 3 to the 64th power number of elements in the simplest living thing. And the most complex non-living thing was something like 207, you know, showing that there must be a presence of the Jivatma to create and gather all of these elements together. I know you know that on the tip of your tongue.
Not really.
I want to get that formula.
Yeah. I don't know it. Yeah.
Well, you're a nice guy anyway.
There's so much.
I know one was something to the 64th power was the number of you know, almost infinite number of particles in a living, the simplest living thing. What to speak
particles.
Of it?
All
right. I am denied.
Crystals. Okay. Yeah. And
things are made of atoms. And interestingly, I think it's In the Lila of Vitrasura, King Parikit is inquiring from Sukadeva Goswami, and he's saying that verse Rajobi Samasankhyata Partiva Ihijantava. He says that the human beings in this world are as numerous Samasankhyata means the same count Rajobi, which are atoms. Partiva Yajantava. So the living entities in this world are as numerous as atoms.
Wow. Actually, the word you can say is innumerable. Innumerable.
But do you get my question? Do you understand my question? There's this thing, liquid crystals, which they think are almost living. They're not living, but they react to heat and pressure, and they look like flowers, and they flow, and they move as though they have independent life, but they don't. And scientists admit they don't. These are non-living. And they're comprised of a couple of thousand elements. But the simplest living thing has unlimited. I know it's something to the 64th power number of elements.
Yeah. I think
What do you mean by elements?
He describes it. He's comparing apples to apples. In the liquid crystal to the It means all the, and not atoms, because, you know, on the head of a pen there's the same number of atoms as on the head of a liquid crystal. But the particles that comprise this, let's say, well, water is H2O, so there's two. Uranium has how many? 16. So this liquid crystal has some
16
number.
Protons?
Whatever.
Oh, you mean the atomic number?
Yeah, well, that's one way, but this is molecules and particles and plasmas all combined compared to the most complex liquid crystal, an element that they know that is non-living, compared to maybe the amoeba, which has something, I know it's, I remember the 64th power number of particles and parts in its composure.
Ah.
And it's just a dumb little germ. Indra Gopa.
I think Nassim Harman may have an answer to that if you want to contact him. Nassim Harman?
He's the Muslim fellow?
Yeah. I think he's in Hawaii. Yeah, he's in Hawaii.
Nice stuff. Yeah.
He might know that because he's dealing with all these things to, you know, toroids and...
Yeah.
But that in a simple way, can cut through so much. You plant a seed of a plant, you put so many pounds of earth, so many pounds of water, but the tree grows into tons of a gigantic tree. Where did all these elements get gathered and assembled into a tree weighing much more than you put into it?
Yeah.
Proof of a presence of some non-material, jivatma.
Yeah. Actually, their book, Forbidden Archaeology.
Yeah.
It's not trying to prove, that life comes from matter, but the focus there is trying to show that there's an extreme bias in science.
Mm-hmm.
And science, they don't lie, but they stretch.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought him up because I must testify that. I thought UFO conferences were a bunch of, guys with tinfoil hats. When you see the competent people of high-level government security clearance testifying about these things, it changed my entire understanding of his work.
Yeah.
Really, these are very, very serious testimonies of very important former military and government officials that come out. Yeah.
I think, as far as I know, Ecuador, which is not a very big, powerful country, but they do have an air force, is the first country where the government is actually now requiring, but most governments actually forbid pilots to talk about their experiences. They'll pull their license if you say you saw something. But Ecuador... Ecuador is now requiring all their pilots to report their experiences to one agency and one science like that. Mm-hmm. And so right away, so many pilots are starting to come forward and say, I saw this, I saw that. So we're not alone.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to confess my testimony that I had doubts. I thought, well, he's going to these wacko meetings. No, they are extremely high-level people there.
There was a... we're in Tennessee, in Nashville here, so trying to relate to our local people.
How's Elvis?
We haven't seen him for a while, but they still hear him playing at some time, along with Johnny Cash, I guess. This is one of the biggest battlefields, graveyards, east of the Adirondacks, something like that, because 40,000 people died here, And there were a lot of ghosts floating around. Yeah. But amazing, they've all gone now, pretty much. We've got some kirtan, regular kirtan. Anyway, the university here had one fellow, Dr. Jaya Labaf, and he came from the American Academy of Science, which was established during the Civil War by Abraham Lincoln. To give Congress advice on engineering and science like that. So it's a national science academy. And then, interestingly enough, it doesn't have any money coming in or something like that. It's a strange thing. They have to do their work. So anyway, he was here because the school here has about 20,000 students, and it started as a teacher college, and still is predominantly, you know, a teacher training college. And so they were here to try and, you know, convince the prospective teachers that they should all teach evolution like that, you know. And the program was two deans of the university introduced it in the evening, and many students were there, obvious, as required, this and that. And he made a nice presentation, because Prabhupada said, you know, that the preaching science in the 1970s is going to be different than preaching science in 2000, you know, 14, 15, 13, like that. And he said science would lose its prestige because people would see, you know, that it wasn't able to fulfill all the claims it made. So Professor Labov, or Dr. Labov, he's a pretty high guy in the institute, he said maybe like about 12 or 14 years ago, they did a survey of how many people believe that, you know, life came from evolution. Maybe like, let's say, 15%, you know, okay. And how many people believe it came from some supernatural source? Okay, 14%. Okay. And how many people didn't give a damn? Okay, 70%. Okay. Okay, so they went about, you know, this effort of going through the universities and publishing brochures and everything else like that and communicating to everybody. And after maybe like, you know, 12 years of this work, they did a survey again. And basically it came back, maybe they nudged it like 0.5%. You know, and they hadn't really changed people's opinions about, you know, science and religion. And so his proposition is now, and their proposition is now, is that, this is what Prabhupada says, that people accept the information from scientists as revealed knowledge. That most people don't have any knowledge about how science arrives at its conclusions, and therefore whatever they, when they believe in scientists, they believe him in the same way they believe in one priest in their church. You know? So therefore, he says, we have to go about this process of in starting to include, you know, education about how science is done in the liberal arts and humanities, and the teachers have to understand, you know, more practically how we scientists, when we say something like this or that, we arrive at a certain conclusion. So then he said, mm-hmm. this would not have occurred, you know, back in the 1970s. He said, but science is just one way of knowing things. There are many other, at this point he kind of wiped away a tear from his eye. He said, there are many other ways, very good ways, of knowing what is life that would not have occurred back in the 1970s. So even they are coming to this point of softening their position that, okay, science is just one way of knowing about what is reality, but it's the best way. So there's a lot of like you say on the, UFOs have received a lot more information. And reincarnation, my gosh, it's just now, I think the guy was, what's his name? He's Emeritus Director of the Mount Zion Psychiatric Hospital in Miami. And so, you know, that's a pretty powerful position of the Jewish Psychiatric Hospital in Miami. You've got to have a lot of money. Got his name, Weiss, Brian Weiss. So he did not believe in reincarnation at all, you know. But he was doing regression, hypnotic regression, and curing people. You know, I cured one girl from the fear of spiders myself. Okay, she had experience when she was a child of a summer camp. So he was doing this. And one of the girls in his hospital had claustrophobia. And so she would have to walk up and down the stairs to her position in the hospital, you know, as a technician every day, six flights. So he told her, Alice, come on in. I'll give you a little help here, you know, no charge. So he started putting her into different hypnotic experiences and finally got her good trance. He said, okay, Alice, let's start to go back. And I want you to go back to the first time, you know, that this fear happened. Okay, what's happening? And Alice said, the Pharaoh said. Okay. Yeah. So the story came out, you know, that she was a serving girl, let's say like, you know, 12 years old, of some high religious bureaucratic official in Egypt, maybe like, you know, 2,000 years before Christ. Okay. Her boss died, and they put her and wife and, you know, and two living girls in the tomb and closed the door. You know, of course. So she developed this real bad attitude towards closed spaces like that. And after that, he didn't believe it. He said, what's going on? You know, because she was getting all kinds of detailed descriptions of Egypt. She's an ordinary person.
Well, the famous quote of Prabhupada is that there are yogis who can dip into the Ganges and come up in the Jamuna. And then he says, I have seen it.
Yeah. From different
places. How did he see it? How did he see it?
Subtle vision. Yeah.
And you know about the revolving door? Do I have time for one?
Let me go over to Brian Weiss a little bit here.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So anyway, he brought her forward, and she kept popping through different things. And finally came down to his own experiences in life, which is things that nobody knew, for sure, in these trances she was talking about. You know? So he started doing more and more past life regressions, got other people doing them. They were curing people. And then the board of psychiatry got, it was too much for them. They were going to call him in and just take away his license and everything else. But he's no fool. So he came in with a few more psychiatrists. He knew several people on the board anyway. He's a big guy. And he presented his case and what he was doing and everything else. And the board kind of huddled for a second and said, okay, Brian, go ahead with this, but be careful. So basically at that point, reincarnation became an acceptable area of research for a reputable scientist. And since then, there have been several very reputable, you know, studies. So reincarnation is also coming to the point where you get really, you know, solid evidence like that, scientific evidence coming like that. Yeah, the revolving door.
No, that's a different story.
Oh.
But we also be careful, because people will come up and claim I'm the reincarnation of Prabhupada. I can see.
Yep. Okay.
But the revolving door is Prabhupada was in a department store with Babananda. And they were leaving, and there was a revolving door in the middle and two swinging doors on the side. And a man gets ahead. You know this? A man gets ahead of Prabhupada, goes in the revolving door with a lot of bags. Prabhupada gets in behind him, and it moves one section, and the man stops to go through his bags. Now, Prabhupada is stuck in that corner, because they don't move backwards. So Babananda freaks. He goes around to the swinging door, goes out onto the street, and Prabhupada's standing there. And the man with the bags is still in the revolving door. I said, well, how did he get ahead of him? He says, I don't know.
Other devotee left his body from liver cancer recently in Vrindavan, but his name. He said, big kirtan, a roaring sound, and probably was doing aarti to the deities.
Wow.
And he wanted a cup to pour the water from the conch shell into, and nobody could hear him. So he said he saw Prabhupada throw the water something like about 15 feet, land in Tulsi Devi's little pot, spin around twice, and sit there. And Prabhupada did it three times, something like 15, 20 feet away like that. It was just, you know, impossible shot for anybody like that. You know? So many things like that, it seems that they were all like, Krishna didn't let them get out until after Prabhupada left, because otherwise he would have been branded as a magician, and everybody would have been coming, you know, for all this stuff. But afterwards, it's actually maybe even a nice book now, you know, before the collecting or before everybody leaves. I had a couple experiences too that were just, you know, not normal. You know? Yeah. But the whole thing is the motivation. That's the whole thing. We're trying to get back to go through the sense of sight, through the sense of touch, through the sense of sound, through the mind, through the intelligence, through the ahankara, and that's the root of the whole thing. So if we can deal with that directly as much as possible, then everything else would just fall in line simply behind it like that.
The thing is, what we must, anyone that has understood reincarnation by scientific, that begs the question, okay, you think you're Joe Blow today.
And
you thought you were Pharaoh's daughter 10,000 years ago. Well, who are you passing through? That's what the question has to be brought.
See?
Not that you, Joe Blow, were Elvis.
Yeah.
When you were Elvis, you thought you were Elvis.
So this. Yeah, the whole thing is, why are we
must
moving?
Bring up the question. They don't ask that question.
No. Some of them do. That's the whole point. Some of them get a little higher, but it's just shakes them loose and a little bit. So anybody else have any other comments or questions like that?
Yeah, I'd like to add something. Going back to the purport, Prabhupada saying in the purport, the Vedic process is to follow in the footsteps of great authorities, and that is the only process for knowing that which is beyond our imagination. And sort of reminds me of the time Prabhupada was told, some Christians say no one has seen God, to which Prabhupada replied, they can say they haven't seen God, but how can they say no one has? So we're relying on Shabda Brahman, transcendental sound, from the Vedas and the Acharyas. But I would like to read through a verse in the 12th canto, right at the end of Bhagavatam, in the last chapter. Somehow Korma is mentioned in the very end of Bhagavatam. And it's a very, very interesting verse, and it goes like this. When the Supreme Personality of Godhead appeared as Lord Korma, a tortoise, his back was scratched by the sharp-edged stone base of massive, whirling Mandara Mountain, and this scratching made the Lord sleepy. May you all be protected by the winds caused by the Lord's breathing in this sleepy condition. Ever since that time, even up to the present day, the ocean tides have imitated the Lord's inhalation and exhalation by piously coming in and going out. And in the extended BBT translation, in the purport, it's very interesting. They quote Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And it goes like this. At times we alleviate all itching sensation by blowing upon it. Similarly, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur explains, the breathing of the Supreme Personality of Godhead can alleviate the itching sensation within the minds of mental speculators, as well as the itching of the material senses of conditioned souls engaged in sense gratification. Thus, by meditating on the windy breath of Lord Korma, the tortoise incarnation, all categories of conditioned souls can be relieved of the deficiencies of material existence and come to the liberated spiritual platform. One must simply allow the pastimes of Lord Korma to blow within one's heart like a favorable breeze. Then one will surely find spiritual peace.
Was he snoring also?
I had been hearing him
snoring a little bit.
It's just breathing. Just breathing.
Very musically. Very musical snoring like that. Goodness. One devotee, Krishna Balaram, you know him, Indian devotee. He was Balaram Sharma, Vrijbasi, and Prabhupada initiated him as Krishna Balaram. He said when they were little boys, they would give the elephants like sugarcane juice, and the elephants would get intoxicated, and then they would roll their heads back and forth in an intoxicated state. They put the little kids on top of their heads, and the elephants didn't even really notice it, you know. He said it was so intoxicating sitting up on the elephant's head, just going back and forth. Okay, I guess we'll stop here.
Can I ask you, where is this PowerPoint on your website? Is it on the website yet?
No, the Chutananda Prabhu was asking about the summary of 12 cantos.
Your PowerPoint, is it on the website?
Yeah, there's a PowerPoint show of our, I give a verbal summary of all 12 cantos. So that's on the website.
Nice.
But
it's a great service.
Oh. Looking for the slides.
Are you looking
like
for the,
a mountain has been taken off my back.
Yeah. Are you looking for the PowerPoint show for the summary of all thought? Yeah, probably under PDP.
Okay, thank you.
Padapadma and something after that.
Thank you.
Okay. Hare Krishna. Okay, so Prabhupada ki jai.
Jai.
Hare Bol.
Thank you, Maharaj.